There's a lot of very important material in the Siman, but I'm not really going to deal with most of it. The first half, which has to do with honesty and not taking stuff, not dealing with stolen property, which seems to be a issue that seems to be not so well known in the from community, because not only is it usher to cheat to give to tzedakah, but it's usher for tzedakahs to receive hot money. Just a minor detail there. Now, with regards to Dina d'Malchus Adina, on some level, I think the entire discussion today is theoretical and irrelevant. It's irrelevant for two reasons. Number one is a passage that, interestingly enough, I did not see cited in the Beis Yosef here, or in any of the Nosei Kelim, except for the Biur HaGra. I happen to know of this passage because I'm preparing Hilchos Avelos. Theoretically, the question is, do you sit Shiva, and do you afford any of the rights of Avelos for a tax cheat? That's a surprise. That should get a few eyebrows. Someone cheated on the taxes, and you deny them rights of Jewish burial. Why? Because Maseches Machos says that someone who's goneiv is a meches, is kielu shofech damim. It's like shedding blood. Now, I can explain this statement to you. The Grog actually quotes it here. Mentions this briefly on the statement about Yiras HaMalchus. But I believe that for anybody to ever give a psak, no matter what their particular shita is, and in some ways krum, in some ways, whether it's krum or not, whether you think it's krum or not, to ever talk about the permissibility of cheating on taxes is sakana. That's the point of Maseches Machos. It is a danger to the Jewish people. I was reading recently a biography of Yitzhak Elchanan. They left it in our boxes, as they've left. Your grandfather has at least, I don't know what kind of shutfus, but we have certainly encouraged the Machon to be putting out the works of Rav Yitzhak Elchanan Spector, for whom our illustrious yeshiva is named. So we've been getting the volumes of Yitzhak Elchanan's material, the reprinted stuff. And finally, they gave us a little, the abridged biography. There is a broader biography. So it's a little bit of hagiographa on some level. Not to say any things that aren't true, or that Yitzchak Elchanan wasn't a giant. He really was sort of maybe the preeminent posek in Europe of the second half of the 19th century. We picked well in the name of our yeshiva. We weren't such a radical place when we picked the name. When was it? 1896, I think, was when he was niftar. That was after the yeshiva was founded. And in it, there was a discussion. He was involved in many things, and amongst them was defense of the Jewish community. And at some point, he turned to Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch to write a defense against anti-Semites who were accusing Jews, you know, of all these things that are said in the Talmud. Now, I have to say, I don't know what Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch wrote in response. I'm sure whatever he wrote, he believed was true. I'm sure Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch was adamantly opposed to any kind of cheating on taxes. In fact, there's a passage in the Aruch HaShulchan here about Dina d'Malchus Adina. I think I mentioned this earlier in the year. It's an astounding comment where the Aruch HaShulchan says that it speaks of the Tsar's government as a just government and the government of England as well. As has been pointed out, the government of England, he had no reason to be machnif the government of England. That might have been counterproductive from the perspective of his censors. So if the Aruch HaShulchan was writing for the censors, it really made no sense. Now, anybody looking back in Jewish history to think that the Tsar's government any time in the last 100 years of the Tsar's regime, and probably go out before that, could be termed a just government, might be something worthy for stand-up comedy. Now, if the Aruch HaShulchan wrote that, it's Kavachomer ben Benosho Kavachomer to probably any Western government that exists today. And as little as I think of many Western European governments and some of their anti-Semitic undertones, if he could write that about Tsarist Russia and even 19th century England, where for the prime minister to become prime minister, he had to shmad, I think it's Kavachomer to any Western government today and to the government of Israel today that Dina d'Malchus Adina minimally is applicable. But I want to go sort of a step further. And I admit this, and I will say this publicly. Some of the things that I find reading in the Shulchan Aruch, I find to be profoundly discomforting. And I think the reason I do so is because, and I've probably said this before during the year, is I live in a certain context. I live with a certain personal experience, as pretty much do all of you. The anti-Semitism that any of us have faced, maybe there are exceptions, but for the most part is negligible, if even existent. And to the extent that any of us have ever experienced it, it comes from I'll call it a rogue element of society, not from government, When an elected official gets up and makes any comment that even remotely reeks of anti-Semitism, they get destroyed in the media, they get destroyed in the public opinion, whether it's anti-Semitic, whether it's, you know, anti-black, whatever it is, it's absolutely and totally unacceptable. We live in a completely different culture. And therefore, to look at the whole discussion of Dina Mahusadina seems very, very strange to us. And you read some of the things, because it's hard for us to conceive of a world in which Jews live as a separate society, as legally, officially second-class citizens, subject to the rule of government. That isn't our world. We sort of don't know that. None of us, thank God, walk out on the street and think that we're going to be killed by some peasant in Washington Heights, and nothing will be done to the peasant, and the peasant isn't afraid of attacking us because we're Jewish, and he knows that the policemen are going to look the other way. That isn't our world. That isn't our world. Nobody thinks that you can attack Jews or other minorities in this country and get away with it with impunity, at least in any places most of us live, and probably any place in this country, even in Texas. And so that was a joke for the Republicans, excuse me. But the point is, we know that it's pasnish. It doesn't happen. I'm not saying that everybody who commits a crime gets caught, but we don't live in that world, in the world that they once lived in. And that sort of leads me to a broader point. And this, I think I mentioned this early in the year, was a machlokes in print between Professor Gerald Blitzstein and Rabbi Broid. And I think that historically Professor Blitzstein was correct, but I think Rabbi Broid was correct in sentiment, at least what I recall. You know, Professor Blitzstein commented that Dina Malchusadina is a very alienating view. It's a very alienating principle. It basically says that we're outsiders and that we have to obey the law of the government or not. You know, are we really bound by it? And if it's off-putting to us, it would certainly be off-putting to our non-Jewish neighbors. It's like we're debating, are we bound by the law of the government? Are we not bound by the law of the government? What does that mean? You're citizens of this country. Now, I think Professor Blitzstein is correct historically that Dina Mahusadina on some level is really an alien. It's a concept dealing with aliens, with foreigners. I think Rabbi Broid is right in the sense that perhaps we might be able to view it as a broader principle, but in some ways, maybe he's wrong in that it's not really shy to talk about Dina Mahusadina from a halachic perspective if you regard yourself as a citizen of the country. Why do I obey the laws? Why do I pay my taxes? You know, it's come and go. Most of you may not have to pay personally taxes, but, you know, coming up in 4 days, tax day is coming. Why do I pay my taxes? Do I pay my taxes because Dina Mahusadina, because the Shulchan Aruch says I have to? The answer is no. That's not why I pay my taxes. I pay my taxes because I'm a citizen of this country, and that's what good, upstanding citizens do. Now, if I weren't a good, upstanding citizen, but I were just a firm Jew, if that's possible even, so I might pay my taxes anyway because according to the Shulchan Aruch, I really have to pay my taxes. But the bottom line at the end of the day, is that the reason I obey the laws of this country is because, not because of Dina the Malchusadina, unless Dina Malchusadina means, it's just the Torah's way of saying that if you're a citizen of the country, you obey its laws because you're a citizen of the country, because that's what good human beings do. Now, in some level, that might be the case, if you hold it like Rashi, that the makor for Dina Malchusadina is in the Sheva Mitzvah Spenoch of Dinim. So if that's the case, sure, Dina Malchusadina, because I'm a citizen. I'm a Jew, and I'm included in that as a Benoch. I'm a Chuyiv in the Sheva Mitzvah also. So of course, I obey the laws of my country because I'm a citizen of the country. If I drive 56 miles an hour in a 55 mile an hour zone, it's not because I say, oh, Dina Malchusadina is in binding, therefore it's okay for me to do it. I do it like every other American citizen who might drive 56 miles in a 55 mile zone, because I rationalize and say the whole purpose of the law is for safety purposes, so 56 is not really dangerous. Okay? And if I don't get caught, I don't pay a ticket. So it'll be like everybody else in the country. I'm sure there are a few hardy souls who never drive more than what it says marked on the speed limit, but we understand. We understand why it's wrong to drive 85 miles an hour in most contexts, but why it's not wrong to drive 56 miles an hour in context. And you know that if the cop is in such a mood and he catches you with his radar gun and it's the end of the month, he needs to make his quota, you may get a ticket for driving 56 miles an hour, and you probably have to pay the ticket, and that's the way it is. Right? But we do, if we violate it, we don't violate it because, I'm not down by it because Dina Mahusadina somehow I've worked out a cheshno. We do it because we're citizens in this country, and sometimes in laws, citizens don't obey them to the letter of law. Maybe traffic regulations are different anyway because they're intended for safety. You know, when it comes to paying taxes, you're supposed to pay every penny you owe because you're paying your share of the things that need to be paid for based upon the way the government's run, and that's the way it is. You get the benefits and the services from the government, you know, and you pay your taxes. You may not love the tax system. You may think you should pay less tax. Lots of people grumble they should pay less tax. Some people I know give, when people complain about how much tax they have to pay, they give them a bracha and say you should have to pay the same amount of tax next year again, right? Because if you don't earn money for the most part in this country, or if you don't have expensive real estate, you don't pay so much in taxes. And so we do the things we do, not because it says in Shulchan Aruch, Kedem Achasadina, but because we're human beings and citizens of this country. So the discussion on some level for me is really purely theoretical. I've said this before, Avi Miller's not here now, but he and I have a little argument about this. I think there are situations in which one can make an argument that it's okay to disobey the law as a conscientious dissenter. I think that mitzad dina malchus adina, one is not prohibited from engaging in conscientious dissent, because I think that's part of a democracy, that if people feel that there are issues of such powerful morality that they have to protest by disobeying the law, by engaging in a sit-in to make the point publicly, so as long as you're willing to accept the penalties that that your government gives to that, so if you're told to move by the police and you don't move as part of a protest, you may have to go to jail and you have to, you know, pay a fine or whatever it is, as long as you're willing to accept that, those are the part of the rules of democracy. And you're not allowed to engage, in, generally speaking, in violence for that, because that's not accepted by the democracy. That would be a violation not only of Chavallah and whatever else, that might also violate Dina Machos Adina, but it also violates your basic citizens' obligations. So I think that, for the most part, when we choose to pay things or do things, we do them because we are good citizens of the country, because that's what it means to be a good human being, not because of a technicality in Shulchan Aruch. When you read the Shulchan Aruch, you have to understand that it's written from a vantage point of Jews living in a society in which they really are separate from society. They aren't citizens of... The Jews were not, for the most part in the history of Poland, really citizens of Poland. They weren't citizens with the full rights of citizens, with the full privileges. They were kept in a cage almost. So when you read so much of what's being written, and some of the stuff was written at better times, some was written worse times, you have to keep in mind that it's speaking about people who were not citizens of this country. They for long periods of time had self-governance, and then the question is how you related to the outside authority. In such a context, I think it's shy to talk about, on some level, Dina Machos Adina and what the Shulchan Aruch has to say. In our situation, I don't think fundamentally it's even shayach. It happens to be that if you violate your obligations as a citizen that every good citizen is supposed to do, in addition to being a lousy human being, you're also violating Dina Malchus Adina. But I don't think that's the terms in which we should view our relationship with broader American society, because we have a tremendous bracha from the Ribbono Shalom. We live in a society in which we are full citizens, we have full rights, we should expect the same obligations, to perform the same obligations, and there should be nothing to talk about beyond that. And if I have a shaila, and I mentioned this before, about certain kinds of taxes that almost nobody pays, and if I pay, I'm paying more than my fair share of taxes, that's a question to be asked from the perspective of what is the law and what does a democratic society say, not what does the Shulchan Aruch say about that. You know, if under democratic principles I'm really still supposed to pay those taxes, and I'm not sure if that's true, but if it is true, then I pay my taxes. I don't look to the Shulchan Aruch, you know, to Dre why I don't have to pay it. And if I'm not obligated to do so, then I don't think Dina Malchus Adina applies either. Now, I should add sort of another note in this before talking about the theories of Dina Malchus Adina. There's one line in the Ramah, I think it's in the Ramah, which is actually stunning. Here I wish to say that in theory I would disagree, not in theory, in practice, it doesn't, in theory, because it doesn't exist in this country, I would disagree with a comment that the Beis Yosef quotes from the Ma'arik, and I think the Mechaber himself doesn't quote it, but I think that the Ramah does quote it. In Sif Vav, if you look at Sif Vav for one moment, when the Mechaber talks about what is a legitimate tax, he says, "Vamed devar mamurim shamoches kalistim." When is a tax collector assumed to be a thief? Bizman shamoches akum. I want to talk about that later in shir, so I'm going to come back to this. Omoches omen meilav. Omoches amelach. Omen mechamach samelach ve'en lo kitzva. A mechash ein lo kitzva. Tax where there's no fixed tax. There are no rules to the tax. You know what the rules are? Elman, I think feel like taking $100 from you. I'm going to take $100 from you. Lamb, I like Republicans today. I'll take $20 from you. Berkovitz, said, I don't think you work hard enough, I'm going to take $200 from you. That's a mechash ein lo kitzva. That's not binding. That is not morally, that is not binding mitzad dina machos adina, and if you can get away with not paying that tax, that's fine. Now, what is the definition of a mechash ein lo kitzva, or sheyesh lo kitzva? So if you look in the Ramah, in parentheses, if that's the Ramah, I'm not sure, v'afilu tziva sheyisrael yiten yoser me'akom, mikom akom mikri davar katzav l'chalish. Even if the law says that Jews pay an extra tax, it's a fixed amount for Jews, fixed amount for non-Jews, you have to pay it. That's called the Mechash Eishel Kitzvah. Lefianis daiti, that's not true anymore. I don't know if it was ever true, but I morally object to such a principle. I obviously do so, and it's obvious to you why, because I'm an American. And the idea that a person of a particular ethnicity or religion pays more because of his ethnicity or religion is morally offensive to me. I assume as anybody here, it's not morally offensive to, not that you'd raise your hand. I think you all agree with me on this, so maybe I'm probably preaching to the choir. The idea that such a tax can be valid in any civil society to me is just beyond imagination. Now, in the world in which the Rama lived, halavai that the tax system of taxation should be fair, and it's just that if you're a Jew, you pay an additional Jew tax, but you know exactly what it is, and the rule of law applies. It might have been from the Marik's perspective. Marik's writing that the Marik lives where? He starts out in Germany. He's from Cologne in Germany. I think he winds up in Italy, though. But from the Marik's world, maybe that was a bracha if Jews knew exactly what they had to pay. In our world, such a tax would be invalid. It could never stand. As you well know, in this country, no tax could ever pass. No tax like that could ever stand in the courts. But should there be such a tax in this country, I would state categorically it would be morally offensive and not binding, neither from the perspective of Dina Machusadina, nor from the perspective of being a citizen. So you could put aside the Dina Machusadina part. It wouldn't be binding. Of course, it's easy for me to say because no such tax is conceivable within our framework of democracy and our framework of law. Perhaps if I lived in the world of the Rama or the world of the Marik, I would have thought differently, but I don't. So that's the way I see it. But I raise this to realize, to think about, I mean, could any of you theoretically on your own conceive of such a thing being called a Mechas Sheish Lo Kitzvah? I don't think so. You can't because of the world in which you live. Okay. Now, what is the underpinnings for Dina Malchus Adina? So I would suggest that there are basically three, there may be two models, but basically the two primary models on which Dina Malchus Adina can be based. On some level, the language of Dina Malchus Adina, that language suggests one of the two models depending on how you translate the word Malchus. One view, Rashi first, what is the makor for Dina Malchus Adina? Is it the Raisa? Is it the Rabbanan? So there is a machlokas of Harishonim here. Rashi and Gittin on Daf Tes in the discussion of Shtaros Ha'olos Barakos Shel Akum. So Rashi writes that the basis of Dina Malchus Adina is Dinim. There are Sheva Mitzvos Nitztavu B'nei Noach, and one of them is to have laws. So Rashi assumes that Dina Malchus Adina is binding because it's part of Dinim. It's not a narrow form of dinim, as suggested by the Rambam and Hilchos Malachim, that the purpose of dinim is just to have laws and courts to enforce the other six mitzvahs ben noach, but more along the lines of the Ramban, that it's an expansive idea that a society has to have laws. And you need to have judges for the laws, and that's what dinim is, and dinim achosadina is part of that. There is a position, it's on one of the makaras on the sheet, that dinim achosadina is a din derabbanan. And the Tachamim was misakin that you have to follow the law of the land. I find this, again, to be somewhat strange because from a purely theoretical basis, you have to follow the law of the land because you're a citizen of the land. But okay, in a world, again, where Jews weren't citizens, where they were outsiders and kept as outsiders, maybe perhaps such an opinion might be warranted. If you're treated as an outsider, maybe you're not obligated to follow the laws. Mark?
Shmuel is the only one who talks about that term.
Shmuel is the author of that, yes. Well, the question is, how do you know that Tanayim didn't hold of such a concept? So the answer might, so that's a it's a fascinating historical question. In other words, if you want to look at it from a pshat historical perspective within rabbinic texts, you have a couple of Mishnayos and a Braisa which suggest that avoiding the tax is okay. The question is, though, you can't get away with this historicizing without looking at historical context. Think about the historical context of Jewish-Roman relations in the Tanaitic period, right? Would you have defined that as a civilized government? And the answer is most certainly not. So the fact that, in other words, would you, and if you look at the Roman policies of taxation, they were oppressive, to say the least. So the fact is, I could see someone very well have saying, under those contexts, of course you can do anything you can get away with to avoid the taxes. Right, because it's a corrupt and absolutely and thoroughly corrupt government that oppresses, you know, all of its provinces and so on. And certainly the way they treated the Jews, you know, was beyond awful. And so it's hard to make an argument that the Tanaim really didn't hold the Dina Machusadina. They might have not held the Dina Machusadina under a Roman government, and I think we could all agree to that. You know, if we were to take something that was much more extreme, I think it's certainly fair to say that, you know, under the Nazi regime, no one was obligated to follow any laws of that government. That government was an invalid, you know, ipso facto invalid government, and none of its laws were binding in any form or fashion. Well, no. There are laws that may be binding because of universal morality, but if a law that's only a law because it's passed by the government, which might or might not be, might be reasonable, might be unreasonable, we'll talk about more about what is a valid government, and that merits discussion, but I think it's fair to say that there's certain kinds of governments that are not valid governments. A government that seizes force by, that seizes power by force and is not really recognized and acknowledged by the people whom it governs is certainly not a government. And a government, again, I realize we can debate, every government has corruption in it. There never has been a government, or a king probably, but certainly never been a government without some kind of corruption. I don't think that invalidates a government. I think there's a line between a malchus, which happens to have occasionally listim in it, and a malchus shalistus. There is a difference between the two. And it's fair to say that I think that the United States government and the governments of most Western democracies certainly, I think, are beyond question a malchus that may occasionally have listim in it, but not a malchus shalistus. There may be a few Western governments where you start to ask the question, you know, whether the way of the world is you only do things with graft and things like that. And then it becomes a complicated issue. You know, what, is it mutter at least to work with graft because that's the way the system works? I'm afraid to say that those questions sometimes arise about a certain beloved government on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean, a beloved government of ours. But fundamentally, I think still, the Dina Malchus Adina, you'd be hard-pressed to find any democracy in which we wouldn't call that a fundamentally a binding Malchus. So anyway, but from Rashi's perspective, it's a question of Dinim. Otherwise, you might have to say it's a Takana de Rabbanan. Now, what is the conceptually, what is the governing conceptual principle of the Dina Machus Adina? So here I think that basically there are, really you can break things out into little details and conceptual possibilities, but fundamentally it boils down to two things. And this is a debate that historically speaking, and I haven't gone back to read the material I was taught as a school child in history, but I remember there being an argument about the divine right of kings. And the divine right of kings, I suspect, was actually a fairly late concept. The divine right of kings is probably asserted in response to a challenge from nobility of trying to assert power, so therefore you need to assert, it probably starts in England, doesn't it?
It was France.
Right, but as a school child, I didn't have the sophistication to realize that when a king has to say he has a divine right, it's because his power is really being questioned and this may not be as firmly established, right? You don't realize that as a child, just as you don't need to create papal infallibility or Das Torah until your authority has been undermined and severely challenged. Which is why, as I like to say, they both developed in the latter part of the 19th century as modernity has loosened the bonds and the strength and the authority of religion. Papal infallibility is, I think, 1871, the Fourth Something Council. So the question is, where does the right to govern come from? For a king or for a government? It's really a fundamental chakira. Does it come from God? Does it come from some inherent rights that the king has, however he became king? Or does it come from the consent of the governed? And you guys, all as good, loyal, faithful, any non-U.S. citizens here? And none of my Canadians are here right now, right? So all know, of course, that it comes from the consent of the government, we the people. None of us would ever want to live in a society otherwise. None of us would want, I don't think, if anybody dissents about what I'm saying, please raise your hand, because you know I certainly tolerate dissent. I don't think any of us would want to live in a government with an autocratic king, with a dictator, none of us live in a society run by the Ayatollahs or any equivalent to that. I don't think any of us would want to live in such a society. Some might think that we're supposed to, but I don't think any of us would want to live in such a society. I think we all love the idea of a democracy. I think most of us are really hoping the Mashiach comes, I think. I don't know, some of us are hoping that Mashiach is a democratic system, if you're allowed to say that. I don't know. But I certainly, none of us might have to live under Mashiach. If that's what the Ribbono Shel Olam commands, that's what we do. But I think we all like the idea of a democracy. We all like the right to vote. We all like the right to be able to voice our opinion freely, having freedom of speech. I don't think any of us would voluntarily surrender such a right. It's really godless. It's a great thing. And so I think all of us, of course, think that the basis of government is we the people. I think that's very clear. That is, by the way, the Rashbam's position in Cheska Sabatim and Dafnu and Dalin, and it is articulated by others as well, that basically the right Dina de Malchusa is a function of the consent of the governed. Okay? There is another position articulated by the Ran in Nedarim and other Rishonim as well, is that the Eretz belongs to the Melech, and therefore, if you don't want to follow the rules of the king, he can throw you off the land. We don't, I think, now, why is that significant? That's significant in religious politics now, because there are those who made the following argument. I kid you not. The Ran does say, I'll just say categorically, it's wrong anyway. It's wrong because Shmuel, because it's beferish against the Bavli, and why the Ran didn't realize this, I don't know. As Mark pointed out, well, there are a number of Mishnayos that sound like you don't have to pay. Hold on, I know I haven't said what it is yet. But I didn't say it yet. So let me say the Ran first. The Ran says that Dina Malchus Adina is because the Eretz belongs to the king, and if you don't want to follow his rules, he can throw you off the land. He can say, you can't live on my land. Therefore, the Ran says, Dina Malchus Adina only applies to Malchei Goyim, not to Malchei Yisrael. Now, he doesn't mean Malchei Goyim versus Malchei Yisrael. He means Chutz La'aretz versus Eretz Yisrael. Why? Because Eretz Yisrael doesn't belong to the king, and therefore, he can't throw you off the land. Therefore, Dina Malchus Adina isn't really doesn't govern. The reason why I say that that fundamentally cannot be is because the Gemara poses a stira between Shmuel's statement, Dina de Malchus Adina, and the Mishnah, which says that you can cheat the Moches. So the Gemara says, how can you cheat the Moches if Dina de Malchus Adina? So what's the Gemara's answer? The Gemara's answer is if it's an unjust tax, or Moches Yenu Kitzva, Moches HaOmen Me'elav, and so on. Now, according to the Ran, the answer was Pashat. Where did Shmuel live? Where was the Mishnah written? Eretz Yisrael. How come the Gemara didn't say Ha Eretz Yisrael Ha B'chutz La'aretz? It's a davar pashut that can't be what the Gemara held. It's a davar. Why the Ran didn't realize that? I don't know. Why he didn't think to say that? There are other Rishonim quoted by the Rama. The Rama doesn't quote the Ran. Rav Shechter insists the Rama doesn't quote the Ran, and we of course do not paskin that way. You understand that that justification is used by some people in Eretz Yisrael to say they don't have to pay their taxes because after all, there's no dina machus adina. Aside from so Rav Shechter likes to say the Shulchan Aruch doesn't quote the Ran. I'm not so sure it's true. It's true the Rama doesn't quote the Ran, but he quotes the same principle of other Rishonim. I'll talk about that in a moment. But as Rav Shechter's pointed out absolutely correctly, you can't argue, we don't pay taxes. It's the point I made earlier in Shir. When we pay our taxes, we're not paying taxes to the king or the government as a present to them, their rights to collect it. We're paying taxes fundamentally for the services that we get in exchange for the government, for the roads, for the utilities, for the army that protects us. Said if you live in Israel, it doesn't matter where you live, the government builds your roads, the government builds your wires that go overhead. The government pays to fund your yeshivas and to provide for your poor. Well, how ridiculous is it? Can anybody get up there and say, well, I don't have to pay because Dina Malchusa? It's not Dina Malchusa, it's a shutfus, it's a partnership. We pay our taxes because we get things back. And if we didn't get things back, the government has no right to take our money. It's not to enrich a melech or enrich a government. So the whole notion of saying that you pay your taxes because of Dina Chosadina is absurd. It's utterly and thoroughly ridiculous. That's a quotation, virtually. Chayav Adam Elomar B'Lashon Rabba. As he would say, it's dach ridiculous. And so the fact is, of course you're mechuyav to pay your taxes. Now you think this is a joke, but one of my beloved former students, who was still in the shir last year, sent me an email for my entertainment from a nouveau Haredi friend of his, who was Clary Hakira, why he thinks he's obligated to pay the municipal taxes, because that's like Shiva Tovei. This person was quoting some Rav, saying this, because it's Shiva Tovei Ya'ir, and that you have to pay. But the central government, you don't have to pay, because it's Dina Machos Adina. And my student just wrote back to him, and said, and then you're going to be complaining when the government isn't giving you enough money for your yeshivas? How ridiculous and corrupt. Oh no, there was more to it, because it was worse. It wasn't just that he said, the Sheet of the Ran, you're going to like this better. I don't know if we've discussed this year, but there's a principle in Dine Mamanos. I don't know how it's practically applied, because it would destroy a Lachosha Mishpat, called Kimli. You know what Kimli is? Kimli is if there's a Machlokas HaRishona, Machlokas HaPoskim, that's not absolutely, clearly, thoroughly resolved one way or the other. I can say in a Din Torah, I elect that Sheet, and you can't collect the money from me, because I'm Motzi Mechav Alef Haraya. Now, I don't know. I'm not a Dayan, but if I were a Dayan, I would never allow Kimli into my basement. I don't care who says it. How do you function that way? That someone can find the minority opinion and say, well, Kimli, I hold like that position. I'm Otsi Mechalav Araya. But anyway, it does exist. This person didn't invent it. But he said, since there's a Machlokas HaRishon and what the basis of Dina Machus Adina, and everybody knows that there's a Shita the Ran, that Dina Machus Adina is implied to Israel, so I can say Kimli and the government would have to prove it in order to collect my taxes. Now, why does that make me even more upset? Because it's showing how clever you can be to cheat. To be a cheater and a thief. Okay, because now you know more of Choshen Mishpat, so now you can show, now I know how to do it. So it's totally ridiculous because, again, we don't pay our taxes. There may be some politicians here and there, more than here and there, who unjustly enrich themselves, although typically not taking our tax money. It's the things they do with it eventually and the jobs they get after they leave government. But nonetheless, fundamentally speaking, we pay taxes to pay for the services, to pay for army, to pay the service on our debt, to pay for Social Security and Medicare, which many of us will eventually collect some part of. We hope we'll collect some part of. To pay...
That's like very encouraging. That's like a very expansive view of what we can rely on in terms of Sankalabai. They should be so mindful for other things.
I, of course, but you know. So the question is, you can always ask the question, when do you say it's Safi Gezit?
They allow women's Megillah reading and not covering their hair, I assume.
Like, no, but don't you have to understand, Isur Lechud and Mamona Lechud. I'm sorry the tape can't pick up the smile on my face. That Isur, Safek Ishi, you have to be Machmi, no matter how remote the Chumra is. Safek Mamonos, Hamot Simechabel of Haraya. Of course, you have to know that there's also an issue of Safek Geza, but they would say, on the Mosak, on the money, so the government has to prove it. If you have to turn to Shulchan Aruch to figure this out, you've already lost three quarters of the battle. It is so utterly ridiculous. I said this before, I'll say it again. Tikkun HaOlam is not the only principle in Judaism, but it is a principle of Judaism. Yadus exists, and we exist to make the world a better place, to sanctify God's name for all Jews and for all non-Jews. If you lose that point, everything is lost. Nothing else you do can matter. And there's a reason why the biggest Avera in the Torah is not Shrichos Damim per se, is not Gilui Arayis per se, is not Avodah Zarah per se, it is Chilul Hashem. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, go kill Plony, or go be Bol and Erva, or go worship Avodah Zarah, and if not, I'm going to kill you, and out of fear of your life, you do it, what Avera have you violated? The Rambam says in Perakei of Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, you have not violated Avodah Zarah because you are honest. You have not violated Gilei Arayis because you are honest. You have not violated Shvichas Damim because you are honest. What have you violated? V'chilalta Eshem Hashem Elokecha Ani Hashem. You have violated V'lo Sechalalu Eshem Kodshi. Because the value which stands above everything else in Yadus is Kiddush and Chilul Hashem. And there's no onus when it comes to that. You choose to sanctify God's name, even if it means giving up your life, or you choose to desecrate it by not giving up your life. There is the supreme value in Yadus is Kiddush Hashem, an avoidance of Chilul Hashem. And if you don't understand that, the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch are not going to help you a whit on the Yom HaDin. Not a whit. Okay. So anyway, but from a legal perspective, those are really the two principles. Does it go because the king has rights to the land, and the king is the owner, and therefore he has the right to throw you if you don't follow his rules? Or does it go from the Haskamas Toshavei HaMedina? Okay. Now, yes. We're paying for the things we use.
Right. So are you saying that all these discussions about dealing with the Medina were in the Shulchan Aruch, it was a question of whether they are included to enrich the government?
Well, basically, if you want to look from a historical perspective, you pay taxes to the government, you didn't get anything in return.
Well, you did, in pre-modern times, you really did.
You had the protection of the state.
Yeah, meaning you were part of the king's purse once you paid the taxes.
Again, what Jews received,
okay,
they weren't really citizens of the realm.
I did.
But you understand it's very, very different than today.
Yes, obviously.
Okay, so what I am saying is that I believe that this discussion is essentially irrelevant lahalacha. The only perspective in which you ask questions about the binding nature and the applicability of secular law to us is as citizens, not as Jews. And as a citizen, do I really have to pay this tax? Is this an invalid tax because nobody else is paying because I'm being... In other words, it goes by the rules, of our democracy and what the morality of our democracy is, not anything that says in Shulchan Aruch. Because from the perspective of our government is fundamentally religion blind. The IRS doesn't know me as a Jew or as a non-Jew. Same thing. It's not to say, by the way, on the basis of Dina Machos Adina, I wouldn't be obligated to pay anyway. I'm not saying that Dina Machos Adina doesn't also apply. I'm just arguing that any of the loopholes or parts that it doesn't address are almost irrelevant. There are some very important issues that are relevant, by the way, but they're not about our obligations to government or society. It has to do with interactions between two Jews, which is that long shach that I gave you at the end, a very, very important shach, machlokas shach haramah, that you must know about. Okay. Anyway, so with that very long introduction, after Sif Aleph, what's the first thing that I gave you to look at? Vav. Okay, fine. Sif Aleph. Yeah, sure.
Are you going to do the Rambam or are you going to do Shomar?
What Rambam about? The Meches?
Part?
No, I'm not going to do that. I gave you sort of really a distilled version of that sheet. I'm sorry, I should have been clearer on the email, but I assume that reading through the other Bekorah sheet wouldn't take you very long. And so I figured even if you read that first, you then go to do the basar v'yayin, you do the meat and potatoes. Yes. You can ask the question, but the Rambam is going to be quoted mostly here anyway, okay, in the Shulchan Aruch. Go ahead, what's your question? I'll tell you if I want to wait on it.
The Rambam pretty much says on the Torah that he cuts down trees to make a gesher, you're allowed to get an offer from it because that's within his right. I think the Rambam in Malachim Pei Gimel implies that for a Mel Yisrael, you can't do that. You can't do certain things unless it's in a time of Malchama. At least that's the way the Lecha Mishnah reads them. And I wanted to know why that would be.
So the answer to that is that there the king is taking, I would say the following, that is property taken ad hoc because the king needs to go in a certain place. That is not a system of taxation. That's not katsuv lakol. That's not saying I need $100 for my army, therefore the 100 of you each pay $1. That's I want to go here, I'm going to smash through your property to take it. Right? That's in effect not katsuv.
But it says the Rambam says that Malachim is allowed to do it. He's within his right.
Correct, but again, it has to be under. It still has to be a mechashesh lo kitzvah. In other words, they have to be. The point is that the government takes trees to build bridges. There are fixed rules. I'm not telling you to distribute equally. They run throughout the kingdom. In fact, one of the points the Shulchan Aruch makes, the Gemara makes, is that the king sometimes tax collectors have the right to collect locally from one spot, and then that person goes and collects from the other people. But at its core, it's that everybody shares the burden. Once you mention, by the way, that passage, I also want to note something. I misread this Gemara for a long time, but I'm coming to think that there's a hidden meaning in it. I always used to read that Gemara in light of Rav Schechter's comment about Shutfus, is you see from the Gemara that Din Malchus Din applies because the government builds things and we all use them. That's not actually what the Gemara is saying, although it might be sort of a second layer of meaning. The point of the Gemara is you know that Din Malchus Adina, because if it weren't, then when the government takes trees from people and builds bridges, those objects would be stolen and would be usher for us to use them. Not from the government perspective, from a Torah perspective, we'd be using stolen property. The fact that we are permitted that we do so indicates that we hold that it's actually legitimate. And that shows that Dina Malchus Adina. But the flip side of that, it's not what the Gemara's intent was, is that the whole point is that the government takes this property and we all use it because that's what governments do. Now, their governments may have done more than that. But nonetheless, so I just wanted to make that comment about that particular Gemara that you raised. So, but I think the resolution is that when the king, when it's not a system of taxation, but rather it's an ad hoc thing that's done on the spot, that a king, Jewish king, only does during war. Because during war, the king has the ability for war needs to sort of, supersede, individuals' property rights when it's needed for the war. And typically what that really is poretz lasos lo geder. Right, I need to get my troops from here to there, and I'm going to run over your fields because that's the only way to get there.
Yeah.
But if you want to see an analog to that, that's more like the Takanos of Yoshua Ben Nun. That's not about a king. That's not Mitzad Dina the Malchus Adina. There is another question, by the way, which I've glossed over. There's another possibility of understanding Dina Malchus Adina, which has been discussed extensively, which is relating to Mishpat Hamalucha. But I don't really want to deal with that. And the Rishonim, I don't think really. I don't. None of the Bishonim eyesight. I'm not trying to actually deal with that. You look puzzled. Mishpat Hamalucha. So let's assume for the moment that's not under normal circumstances. A Melech Akum also couldn't do that if it weren't for war.
No, but in Rambam Hukok Zeila Vaveda, it's not a context of war.
No, I know.
He says that a Melech Akum couldn't do that.
Read it for me. Read it for me.
Melech Shikari Lomim Shalvali Batim Batim Yasher Musar La Vorla Batim Paris Batim Batim. It's not the Chama. He's allowed to do it. Where Melech Yisrael is not.
I don't think that there's fundamentally a difference. I think that these were typical regulations of Melech Hakum. That's all. Okay, so one other note, because I don't remember if the Shulchan Aruch mentions that I have to mention. There's a machlokas that we shown about a king making new laws. Can he make new laws? And some Rishonim say, no, it's not binding. Only the old laws are binding. Now, really, on some level, it's not really a machlokas. It's a machlokas. Really, the issue is a king can only make certain kinds of laws. And to the extent that it's mehaskamas kosher, I mean, because I could see someone saying this, well, you know what?
What does that mean, the old laws under Daraisa?
I understand. The whole point is, I think that that view stems fundamentally from a notion that a king's rights are only governed, are limited by what the consent of the population. And therefore, to the extent that a king makes new laws that are not really accepted by the population, they may not be binding. There's even one Rishon who makes the link explicitly of the Rishonim I gave. It might be a Ramban, either directly or a quotation of the Ramban, that basically you can tell that it's because if the Toshvei HaMedina haven't agreed to it, then it's not binding. Because right? I feel the need to mention, the Mechaber doesn't even quote the sheet. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think he quotes this. But I feel the need to mention that because someone could read those sheet and we show them and say, oh, so you see that new laws aren't binding. So if the government, you know, if the Obama administration hikes taxes, I don't really have to pay it because it's a chok chadash, right? Which is ridiculous. The truth is, in this context, the law of this country is that Congress passes the laws and the president signs on it. And if a law is, and the Supreme Court gets to sign its constitutionality. And therefore, if you pass a law, if Congress passes a law and the president signs it and the Supreme Court rules it constitutional, then that is an old law, not a new law, right? Because that's in accordance with how the laws are made. We have, thank God, we live under a great system of government. And I'm an American citizen already. I'm not saying that, so I'm going to pass the test. Okay, I was always an American citizen. Fine, so the Mechaber says, Sifalos. Asur liknos davar hagazol me'agazlan ve'asur l'sado al shinuyov. I'm not sure what this means. I think it means that to help the guy make a shinu rishus. I think that's what the Sma does say that. You're not allowed to assist the gazlan disposing of stolen property. That's basically more or less serving as his fence, either as on a regular basis or on an ad hoc basis. Why? Shekola osa dvarim elu chayotze bo. I'm not doing the rest of this part of the simon because it's all about whether you're kona and when you're not kona. Needless to say, those of you involved in any kind of communal enterprises, you understand on the basis of this alone that it is absolutely usher to take money from someone who has made their money through improprieties. And it's also not such a davar pasha taking money from someone, even if they have legitimate money, it's not so pasha that you're allowed to take money from them for tzedakah, even though some of their money is legitimate, even up to that amount. That may be a machlokas harishonim. The only thing that's befeirish mutter is that if you have someone who's coming to take your property, I should say the following. If someone is doing a property exchange with you, and the property they're exchanging with you is legitimate property, that may be mutter. But beyond that, just to take the money on other purposes, to be nene without just a straight-up swap, that's from Natlu Mochs and Eschamoro. You can take a chamor that they give you. But other than, and that may have been stolen property, but outside of that, it's not so pashut. So the bottom line is if someone has acquired money, ill-gotten gain, one should not be accepting money to tzedakah from them. It is one thing, it's important to make this distinction, you still might not want to accept the tzedakah, but if someone has committed a crime, but their money is essentially legitimately earned, that doesn't mean institution you can't take tzedakah from them. You probably may not want to in the sense that it's inappropriate to show honor to such a person, but just because a person violates an avera doesn't mean that they're not allowed to give tzedakah or that fundamentally that tzedakah shouldn't be accepted. The issue in that case is just giving kavod to a rasha. But if someone's money, dirty money, or even a large part of their money is ill-gotten gain, it is sometimes usur and probably always inappropriate to be accepting such money for tzedakah. It is fundamental chil Hashem. There seem to be a lot of Jewish institutions that don't seem to get that. I will say that for YU, I'm not aware of them ever intentionally taking money that they're aware of ill-gotten gains. I can't say that everybody who gives money to yeshiva is engaged in the most noble and honest form of business, but that doesn't mean it's ill-gotten gain. Okay.
When
I say ill-gotten gain, I mean gzeila geneva. You know, if a person, look, there are areas of life which are not the cleanest businesses in the world. Okay, they're a monas nekiyah v'kal, not a monas nekiyah v'kal. I'm not suggesting because someone is a monas, which is not so nekiyah v'kal, therefore they should be banned and the money shouldn't be accepted. And certainly there are some well-known donors to this yeshiva, you know, who you raise your eyebrows about, but there's a big difference between that and taking funny money, and taking money that's ill-gotten gain. That's absolutely awesome. The other is more a public policy question, and showing cover to certain people maybe is not always optimal. And I'm not even saying people committed crimes. I'm not even saying people committed crimes. You know, but when you're in money, people got very wealthy on insider trading, so that's money that should not be taken. There's a non-Orthodox Jewish institution, much to their credit, I believe, that in the 80s, before probably any of you were born, or maybe a few of you were just born, received a large amount of money from a Jewish financier who was then subsequently convicted of insider trading, and the institution, I believe, returned the money and took his name off whatever. I fear that there are certain firm institutions that would take the name off the building, but wouldn't actually return the money, sadly to say. Okay, so anyway. So the Mechaber writes in Sifav, when the Mechaber had said that property of a moches is assumed to be stolen property, the Mechaber says, "Bamed devar mamurim shamoches kalistin, bizman shamoches akum, o moches ha'omen me'elav, o moches ha'omen me'chamas ha'melech, ve'en lo kitzha, el lokeach ma'a she'yirtzeh." Now, I want to just comment about moches akum here. Moches akum here, why should moches goy be aser? So, firstly, let me explain what this means, lefi pshutan shel dvarim. This doesn't mean a non-Jewish government. There are two systems of taxation. The normal system that we are all used to is that you pay your money to the government. We Americans have a tortured relationship with their government and with their tax authorities. And all Americans, most Americans believe in progressive taxation, but all Americans think that, many Americans think it's the other guy that should be paying the taxes. And people like to hate the IRS, but the bottom line is, at the end of the day, aside from the fact that 50% of Americans are not paying income, they are paying Social Security taxes, which is not insignificant, because there are no deductions for that, essentially. So they may end up actually paying, in reality, the effective tax rate may be higher than some wealthy people, but 50% of Americans will not be paying income taxes this year, any income taxes to the federal government. But people like to hate the IRS. So, you know, many years ago, after I got married, but still a good number of years ago, you no longer make out your checks to the Internal Revenue Service. You make it out to the United States Treasury, which I believe was fundamentally a good shinui, because the message that it delivered is that you weren't paying a bunch of your taxes to a bunch of IRS agents. You're paying the United States, our Treasury, right? Who could argue? The United States Treasury, that's patriotic, that's noble, right? The IRS, that's a dirty word. But the reality is, you're paying ultimately for what you get. In fact, we don't even pay enough of the things that we get, and that's a problem. But this is, let's call this a non-Jewish government. This is direct payment to the government. It could be a Jewish government, a non-Jewish government. That's one form of payment. The other system, which doesn't exist that I know of in modern Western democracies, but maybe I'm wrong, is tax farming. Tax farming says like this. The Roman government wants 1,000, mana or kikarim from the Judean province. They're not interested in getting into bureaucracy. So you know what they do? They find, typically if you're wealthy or not, citizens of the Judean province, and they say like this. You may collect 1,010 kikarim of gold from the provinces of tax, or not. They don't even put a limit on it. And they say, you produce for us, one way or the other, 1,000 kikarim of gold. The rest of it is yours. Whatever else you collect belongs to you. Now, you understand this is potentially a recipe for corruption, because if the government doesn't say you are allowed to collect $1.01 for every dollar you give us, that's a mecha shein lo kitzva. And the Gemara says, that ain't binding. You can evade that tax if you want, if you can. So that's a system. And now here are two possibilities. Who bought the right to collect the taxes from the government? Jew or non-Jew? Now, here is a din that I've already spoken about, which I don't think applies. According to the Rambam, it doesn't apply. The Mechaber does quote it here. The Rambam quotes it earlier. I mentioned this about Havkas Halvah Shalakum. But the way the Gemara treats that is that that's basically the loan. That's a loan. That's a halva that you owe the guy. And so the way the position of the Mechaber seems to be that when it's a non-Jewish king, Dina L'Malchus Adina, once it's a meches that was bought by someone, so then that's not a meches anymore. That's a halva. You owe money to the non-Jewish tax collector. If you're able to evade it, You could evade it. If it's a Jewish tax collector, you're not allowed to evade it because hafkas halva, according to this view, is mutar. Now, truth be told, that's only if you hold hafkas halva of a goy is mutar. So we know it's usher for multiple reasons. But there's a little problem. The Rambam doesn't say it's mutar to be mafkia the halva of a goy. Why not? So we explained last week because the Rambam holds that hafkas halvos is aser because he reads the Maskan of the Gemara differently than Chachmei Ashkenaz, because the Gemara in Bava Kamma Kuf Yud Gimel Amud Beis says that if the only way you can say hafkas halva of a goy is mutter is if you hold that Eved Ifri gufo kanui, right? That's how the Gemara explained the psukim in Parshas Behar, that you have to be medaktik with the goy. So but the problem is that that's a case of halva. The Eved borrows money from the guy and he's going to work it off, but that's a loan. And the Torah says you have to be medakdik. So how can you say hafkas halva of a guy is mutter? So what's the answer the Gemara gives? Eved ivrifi gufoi kanila, so it's not hafkas halva, it's gezel. But the Rambam paskins, as the Gemara says in the other sugyan gittin, that eved ivri is not gufoi kanila. So that's why the Rambam paskins rejects the psak of hafkas halva of a guy being mutter. So how can the Rambam then say that if the Moches is a goy, that it's mutter not to pay the meches? So the Magen Mishnah, I think, already writes there, because he says, stam akum or gazlanim heim. Okay, that's nice, but that's not true anymore, not in our society. So be aware that according to the Rambam, at least, if you hold hafkas halvos is aser, if you hold that it's aser, so then the Moches goy part doesn't apply at all. Then the only time a tax is not binding within Din of the Malchus Adina is A, a Mechashen lo Kitzva, and B, a Moches Omein Me Elav. Okay, then here's that line. Avo Moches Shepsako HaMelech Lital Davar Katsuv, and the Ramah adds, but again, I register my objection from the Marik. The Ramah adds from the Marik, Vafilu Tziva Shi Yisrael Yiten Yosem Eyaku Mikoma Kol Mikrei Davar Katsuv L'Chalish Vehemin Moches Yisrael L'Gavoso L'Melech. And he's a Jewish tax collector to collect it for the king. Vinoda she'adam zeh neman ve'eno mosif klum amasha gazer amelach eino b'cheskas gazlam yishum dedina d'malchus sadina. So there's no gazel assumed here. You're obligated to pay it. Ve'lo od ela she'hamavriach mecha mimecha zeh over alo sigzom meishu gozel manas amelach ben she'amelach Yisrael ben she'amelach Akum. If a Jew buys the tax, he's stealing from the Jew. However, skip the Ramah for just one moment. That's an important Ramah, but I want to come back to it. Avalim kno akam mutar mishum dahave kafkas halvos the shari b'makom daleka chil Hashem. So again, as we said, even within this world, there's always going to be chil Hashem. If the guy shows up on your tax on your doorstep and says, where your taxes, if you don't pay them, that's a chilul Hashem, even if it were considered hafkas halva. Okay, now the Ramah added in parentheses, v'yesh omim dafilu yadua di Yisrael lokeach yosem en ha-kitzvah mikoma kom asr lavriach mimenu davar ha-kotzah davike gozom en ha-gazom da asr. So this is the position that's espoused by the Beis Yosef, by the Ramah. The Ketos happens to argue, I should note that. However, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that even if the tax is unjust, the just part of the tax you're obligated to pay. Is assuming that one could come up with a situation where you were only supposed to pay $100, but the Moches is going to collect more than that from you. If you need to lie to him to make sure he only collects $100, you're permitted to do so. Okay. It's hard to argue with that in principled grounds. Then the Rama writes, and I'll stop for questions after this. V'yesh omrim, da'afilu ha-moches Yisrael, im lokno la'atzamo rak gova la'melech, afo pi da'asul avriach meches dina la'chusa mikomakom, I'm not sure what this Rama means. If the tax collector is not collecting, the Jew is not collecting for himself, but he's just collecting for a non-Jewish king, and that's our equivalent, by the way. That's like the IRS. You don't even have an intermediary. Even though it's aser lavriach meches of dina de malchusa dina, mikoch dina de malchusa, mikoma komon adam avriach en lemoches lachafoso litain tahave kafkas hava osa deshari. I don't even know what this line means. It's aser to do mitzad dina malchusa dina. But the Moches, who's a Jew, shouldn't force him because the other guy who's cheating is only being mafkias as halva. So it's usher to do, but the other Jew shouldn't force him. I don't understand actually what this din means. The whole point is the melech is entitled to collect as a din of chasadina, not as a halva. Then what does it have to do with hafkas avosav? Okay. Anyway, so it's pretty clear that it's usher to cheat on your taxes. Okay. We don't have a moches. We don't have a moches akum, because an akum doesn't. Our IRS. They don't take your money. You pay what your share is based upon the law, and it's not a mechashen lo kitzva, and it's not a moches helman me'elav. And there's, even if you wanted to say havkas havoso shel nachri is mutter, in this case there's no nachri intermediary because you're paying directly to the government. So there's really nothing to talk about. Okay, we'll talk about next week. We will, God willing, finish this. Simon, there's a little bit more, and they will probably have more material that I want to do, a few other topics that we will address before the year is out. Okay. Any questions about Dina Malchus Adina? Okay, so bottom line is, you all understand, you're mechuyev to obey the laws of this land as citizens, and it's also, even mitzad halacha alone, it would be usher to cheat on your taxes anyway. Okay, good.